Good morning, friends on the radio. It's Wednesday. It's 9 a.m. It's time for The Conversation on KMUN. Thank you so much for tuning in. This is our live local call-in show where listeners can call in and weigh in on the topic of the week. Nothing's off limits. We like a conversation that's wide and varied. We like lots of different inputs and opinions. We like to keep it civil, no swearing. And if you do call in, remember that we're on a short delay, which means you need to have your radio off and just listen on your phone while you're on hold, waiting to be patched through to the air room. The number to call is 503-325-0010. And we've got a special guest again today. We've got Ron Craig. Hey, Ron.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing great. Good morning to you.
Yes, so, it is a good morning.
It's been a few good mornings in a row, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
If you're listening from afar, we've been blessed with some very nice weather here in the Lower Columbia Pacific region. Well, we like to start this show off with a little warm-up just to get the phone lines ringing, just to get you talking. So we do an icebreaker every show, and today's icebreaker is, I'd like to hear about your first or worst job that you've ever had. And there's really no limits to this. You could have had the job for 1 hour and walked away and quit, or you could have had it for 40 years. But I want to hear about it. I want to hear about your worst experience in a job. Part-time, full-time, first job, last job, any job. I will go first. When I was in college, I had some friends who worked at a call center that did phone surveying. And so this was making cold calls from computer randomly generated phone numbers that we didn't even know whether they would connect to an actual phone line or not. And you'd sit there in your partition and you'd get through a script. And but first you had to talk them into taking the survey, and hardly anyone wanted to take the survey. And then when you did, you had to do it such a way that if you messed anything up, the survey wouldn't count and your pay would stay at the lowest possible tier. So I think I made it through a whole training shift and then maybe half of a first actual shift. And I told my supervisor that I wasn't cut out for the job, and I walked. So I think that was my least appealing job experience. We've got a call. Good morning. You're on the air. What's your comment or question?
Well, in answer to your first question about, you know, if we've ever had bad work, I have always had wonderful jobs, and I've never had a bad one.
Wow.
It's a real blessing.
That is.
And every job I've ever had, I loved. So I don't have anything bad to talk to. I have always had great jobs. So anyway, thank you for the question.
Well, it sounds like you've done a good job of knowing what you like to do and going after it.
Yep. And I want to tell people that they should dream about what their work they want to do, and then they can go and get education or just find out on the internet what the job is. So anyway, thank you so much for the question.
Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
Bye. 503-325-0010 is the number to call if you'd like to jump in on our icebreaker question to get things rolling today. Ron, what about you?
Well, I was one of these things, like I say, you always go back to your old days in school. And I had this job I think I shared part of it with you earlier. And it was actually training, working for the Internal Revenue Service as a young kid in college, stuff like that. You know, it's just one of those doorway things where they teach you all the ins and outs of it. And of course, you know, the people say, well, it's a great job, you know, working for the federal government. So bottom line is the fact that going through the training and everything, they always gave us ID, and, you know, still being a kind of a young kid, I go into different places, they'd ask for, you know, your ID for, you know, going to have a beer or such and such. And basically when I pull my ID out, people would just, they would go into all different sort of modes as far as looking at that. And because they didn't know, because for whatever reason, I think even today, people still have this sort of thing about the Internal Revenue Service. And I just felt that people were making this judgment against me before they even knew who I was. And can I truthfully say that I probably paid for very few beers back in the day. And even the owners of the businesses walking in, the bartenders, things like that, they would just look at me and then kind of never took their eyes off me. And I just could not, you know, handle that.
Why are you really here, Ron? Why are you really here? Is it the beer?
Yeah, right. Yeah. You know, I paid my taxes.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a stigma to a job at the IRS. Did you have like the windbreaker that said IRS real big on the back? And
yeah, I put it on backwards. They're really trying to get their minds going and stuff. But I know a couple of situations people even watch out the window and see what car I got into. But you know, and so
you didn't have to carry a gun, right?
No, just a sharp pencil. Okay. That was about it. So, yeah. But I couldn't wear that. But like I said, you know, it's not a condemnation, you know, as far as people working for the service and stuff. But it was just not an area that I wanted to go, because you're probably better off being, you know, as far as a policeman, because you didn't have to show your ID, you know, showing your ID and so on and so forth. But it was just kind of crazy and stuff. But yeah, but I had to walk away from it. But it was a good experience, though.
But you found your path.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, hey, the number's 503-325-0010. We still haven't heard from anyone in the wider world about their worst or first job. Heard from one who said they've never had a bad job, which we're all very jealous. But how about you? Give us a call, 503-325-0010. Help us warm up this conversation today. We're going to get into talking about film a little bit after this. But first, we want to hear from you on our icebreaker. So let's get through maybe two more callers. 503-325-0010. In the meantime, if you haven't heard recently in the last 6 or 7 minutes or so, that it's KMUN's Spring Pledge Drive. We are getting very close to the finish line. We've got a goal of $70,000. I don't have the up-to-the-minute numbers, but I believe we're just a few thousand away. So now's a great time to call 503-325-0010 and make a pledge of support to this fine radio station. We've got another caller on the line. It looks like it's Paul. Hey, Paul.
Hey, good morning, you all.
Good morning.
The first job I had, I was, I think, 12 years old. And at the time, we called it Kennel Boy. And what I did was I worked for veterinarians doing all kinds of things. And as time progressed, I learned more and more stuff and was given more and more responsibility. And I worked for three veterinarians. First one was a guy in Bellevue named Dr. Dewey. And we treated both domestic and livestock.
Mm-hmm.
Because back then, there were farms in Bellevue, believe that.
Yeah.
And he was a wonderful person. He really was very supportive. And then I worked for two distant cousins at Lake Hills Veterinary and was given even more responsibility. But well, I worked for a guy named James Foster who did pets but also exotic animals, and he worked sometimes at the zoo.
So what's an example of some exotic animals that would come through the door?
God, they would not come through our door.
He had to go to them?
They were at the zoo. Yeah. And it would be good. Lions, tigers, and bears, oh my.
Wow.
Any kind of, and he was fabulous as well. But I must say, my first job was wonderful. It developed, it was a development of a huge interest I have in animals and always will. And so that's my story.
Well, it's nice that you found your path at a young age and continued to work.
My future as well.
Yeah. Awesome. I love it. Well, keep the phone number handy and call us back once we get into the film combo.
Okay. Was there another question or is that it?
Well, did you ever have a worst job?
Actually, not.
Another lucky, very fortunate person. Wow.
Well, I think so. If I had a worst job, I wouldn't call it the worst because it gave me an opportunity to grow up. I worked in a garbage can pail factory in Kent, Washington, and we made garbage cans.
It's good, honest work.
It Well, yeah, it was very physical, and I kind of enjoyed that part of it, and I learned about a lot about people. I hate that term, everyday people. I learned a lot about people. So it wasn't the worst job, but it was a different job.
Mm-hmm. Right on. Yeah.
All right. I've worn you out.
All right. Thanks, Paul.
Take care.
We'll talk to you soon.
Day.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
And we've got another caller. Good morning.
Good morning.
Oops, sorry about that. Did you have a first or worst job to share with us?
Well, yeah, I thought I would just share the fact that when I was in grade school, I got roped into doing a paper route. I was living in Portland at the time, and it was far enough back where the journal was still a paper, and it was an afternoon paper before the Oregonian sort of absorbed them. Mm-hmm. And so after school, I would go to the paper station, roll up my 35 papers, and go and throw them on people's porches. And then they made us go out and collect, knocking on doors and stuff. I don't think they do that anymore. I don't even know if kids deliver papers that way anymore around here. I get mine over at Cullaby Lake where I live, and some guy comes by in a vehicle. And well, actually, they don't even do that anymore. They send it in the mail, but at any rate, somehow or other, I was offered a larger paper route. So back then it was Union Avenue, which is now MLK. Between Union Avenue, Williams Avenue, Ainsworth, and Killingsworth, which is a pretty good stretch. And I had over 80 daily papers and probably 50, 60 Sundays. And the Sunday papers were probably about an inch thick, mm-hmm. at least.
Wow.
And you had to stuff them with, they would drop off at my house early Sunday morning, the papers, and I'd had to put the inserts, you know, the comics and the Parade magazine and stuff, into the paper. And then I had a double bag over my front tire, and then I had this set of what we call forks that allowed me to have a bag that was in front over the front tire. Mm-hmm. And I filled it. Both of those, all three of those bags, completely full, and I couldn't carry all of my papers out, so I had to make two trips, and I couldn't even ride my bike to start off with. And the thing is, people would stiff me for $1.95. Now, it seems like not much, but back in 1960, it was a lot of money, I guess. But that's what a daily and Sunday cost for a month, $1.95, and I would go to people's houses. And they would, you know, turn off the lights when I rang the door and tell me to come back next week. And finally, I just walked away.
Well, sounds like you built some character.
Yeah, I'm definitely a character, that's for sure.
I think that was what Calvin and Hobbes' dad would say about anything, is that it builds character.
Yes, indeed.
Well, the newspaper industry sure has gone through some changes with the internet. You know, that is not an easy industry to maintain.
Are fading fast.
Yeah, but we're fortunate to have a good local paper here still. You know.
Yep, and I do support it by purchasing their three weekly papers, and I will continue to support that just as I support you guys. KMUN.
Much appreciated.
And
all right. Well, thanks for chiming in on the icebreaker, and stay tuned for the rest of the show.
You betcha. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Well, Ron, let's get into the deeper topic of the day. What do you say?
Sounds like a good course.
So I'm going to hand it off to you because I think you sort of had the seed of the idea for this one. So what's on your mind?
Well, one of the things, like, you know, it's like I said, being a young kid, like I said, we always talk about the idea of, you know, as far as our experience and our own history and stuff. And so with me, film or movies used to be, you know, sort of the criteria of our history. And basically what it would come down to is that we, you know, look at these movies and think that is what it's all about. Historically, and one of the films that really got me going years ago and stuff was How the West Was Won. And we're talking about, you know, a film, I think it was almost 3 hours long, but it took you through the whole course of, you know, how the opening up of the West. And when I looked at it, I said, well, that's really cool and stuff, and looking at this, but, you know, the stars that were in there, I mean, every scene had some, you know, star from that time point. This would have been probably back in, hey, maybe the early 70s, late 60s when this film was out. And the fact that people look at films, even today, to some degree, not as what it used to be. And this is not a condemnation against Hollywood as far as how they put films out there, because it's not necessarily, the history is, yes, the West, and it was one. At the same time, it was one of those things of how the West was really won. And so we didn't see that because, like, once again, they're out there to sell the films. And so to be able to look at these different aspects of, you know, the trappers, or, you know, where the people in the covered wagons, knowing that was really true. And I think I said, once again, the idea that people look at these things, think that the reality of it. So, and going along that course, being, you know, an Oregonian, I would look at different aspects of that, knowing that you don't get, you know, this is the West, right? So what's the idea that covered wagons? And I don't know if, you know, as far as people out there have ever gone to the Baker City, as far as the Oregon Trail. And so after seeing the film, The West Was Won, my next stop was out going out there and seeing what it was all about. And it was like, I wasn't angry about it, the interpretation, but the film at the same time, it was so insightful to see what was really going on. Because, you know, it wasn't Clint Eastwood and, you know, these guys sitting on this couple of series out there called Wagon Train, I believe what it was and stuff. And it was horrific as far as what the people had to go through. And one of the things, if, you know, people out there don't realize, that most of the people, for the most part, were keeping diaries, daily diaries of what was going on. And to me, it was just, they had mentioned in the diaries for the longest cemetery. Because all the people who died on it were different things, from accidents, from diseases, things of that nature. And it's not necessary to spend, you know, a negative role or negative perspective on as far as the history, but that was what it was all about as far as people out there. And they were walking. And it's not that I didn't think that didn't happen, but when you see, you know, the movies and stuff, the people are in there and they're hopping along there and having a good time and square dancing at the end of the day and things of that nature. And then you had the native tribes who were attacking them and all this stuff, which really didn't happen. But, you know, from a, you know, film, you know, from them looking at the films, it's almost like it would have been boring for them to be able to depict the way it really happened. Anyway, Meek's Cutoff was a film that came out a couple of years ago and stuff, which is probably the most dynamic example of what the whole wagon train experience was about. And to be able to see that, it just puts things in perspective. And I think people get a better understanding of the people who were getting on these wagon trains and what they were doing and what happened to them. It was incredible. Like I said, as far as the bravery and, you know, wanting to go out there, they were going to, you know, typically to a better life.
Mm-hmm. So
I think that,
so let's turn this into a question for the folks listening. Using movies as historical references, or the problem with confusing film with history, right?
Right.
Is there a film that stands out to you that was maybe had a big impact on you when you were a kid that you kind of accepted as a narrative about history, and then you learned that in fact things were very different than what the film told you, or maybe you realized that a perspective was just completely left out of a film? Because that's what I think of first when I think of any kind of Western or how the West was won, is where was the perspective of the indigenous people? You know, where's the film How the West Was Lost? That's told from another perspective. Cause I would say that, you know, my exposure to film, you can't help but have it sculpt your attitudes and your beliefs. Even if you know that it's fake, I think that imagery is so powerful.
Well, you're absolutely right. And I think that, like, I'll say once again, like I said, it's not a condemnation of the industry, what they were doing. They're out there trying to, you know, sell, you know, movies and get you in the theaters. And I think for me, it was always like, you know, the landscape. You think of some of the more prominent things in our history, you know, whether it's the Civil War or it's, you know, World War II or however you want to look at it. And I think that, you know, to go back with some certain aspects, you know, that kind of resonate with me is the fact that, you know, we did a lot of projects with the Tuskegee Airmen and stuff. And that was something that was totally eliminated from the history. Mm-hmm. And to be able to see that, and I think I shared one of the before, is the fact that we've done showed the film Red Tails. Took forever to get that out there, just to be able to, because first people said, well, did that really happen? Well, then that's almost insulting to be able to do that. But then yeah, at the same time, there, I was in situations where people were enlightened to that piece of our history and films and stuff, and they were just totally flabbergasted that they were denied that. And once again, like I said, the idea of putting these things out there, and I think for me personally, I kind of turned, I won't say turned my back on a lot of it and stuff, but with the reality, what was going on, I was more like the fact that, you know, let's go to the Wizard of Oz, you know, I could believe that.
Yeah.
And it's just, it was just kind of sad. And like I said, once again, the idea that people would base a lot of their social, you know, opinions, things like that, on things they've seen at a movie or a film, because like, let's face it, like I said, all the Westerns that were out there, you know, cowboys and Indians didn't exist as Hollywood faced them. Mm-hmm. And people go back and look at it, so wow, that's really kind of different. But once again, it's one of those things that the people in the industry thinking, how boring would that be? And so I, you know, personally and stuff, like I said, there were, you know, too many to mention as far as the ones that just, you know, misdirected some of that, some of our history.
Any other examples come to mind?
I think that it's, I don't know, it gets to the point that, you know, I get to the whole, you know, how can I say it, as far as the Birth of a Nation, which was a film that was, you know, alienated a lot of people. And President Wilson actually had the film premiered or showed in the White House. And if anybody's ever seen that film and what it's all about, it's just so misdirected. But you had tons of people that were behind that. And that, to me, was a major benchmark. Like I said, it was, I'm not of that generation that when that film was out there, but still, again, it was played over and over again as far as this is what it's about, you know. And I think I've used that as an example for people, because it was early on, obviously, and then as far as the movies and as far as that industry, but yet again, it's no different to some degree today as far as people being able to put, I was listening to a program on public broadcasting just 2 days ago, the fact that they were kind of discussing the fact of how things have been put out there. Doesn't matter if it's a sporting event or, you know, it's a, you know, as far as a political event, as far as how things and people believe it. And it's just kind of sad to be able to look at, especially, like I said earlier, the fact we have all these options as far as social media to be able to clarify some of these things. But still, again, who do you believe?
Yeah, so I'm taking a quick look at what Birth of a Nation was all about. It's a silent film from 1915, originally called The Klansman. And it was extremely divisive and controversial even before its release. And it has remained so ever since. It's been called the most controversial film ever made in the United States.
So I'm okay with that one.
part fiction, part nonfiction, according to Wikipedia here. But yeah, it sounds like it just sort of glorified the KKK and was part of its rebirth. So a very problematic film.
Well, as you said, part fiction, part nonfiction, that's the whole idea for me and stuff, you know, for people looking at, you know, the, you know, determine what's fiction and what's not fiction. That's where it gets scary.
Yeah, and the concept of historical fiction too, where the line gets even grayer.
Yeah. Well, it's like, you know, back to as far as In the Hood, the idea that the Oregon Trail, you know, I've gone over there a number of times, and this doesn't work with everyone, but I've always felt that in the presence of historical events that I can feel something that happened there. And to be able to sit at sunset, you know, adjacent to the you know, the trenches, the tracks, the course of the Oregon Trail, and to sit there and have a I'll be very frank, where you have a nice bourbon at the sunset and think about it, it's just really incredible. The fact that you're sitting there and all these people come across this trail, the fact of, you know, part of their, you know, they would dump things off. And like I said, the idea was a cemetery. There are so many people that died on the trail, as I said earlier about the call, with the longest cemeteries. And the fact of, you know, how it was all documented, because everybody was writing their journals about what was happening. To me, that was so, you know, insightful to be able to hear that. I mean, to read that and see it, knowing that, you know, it was nothing left or right. This is what happened. And I think that's really kind of a, for me, like I said, I think people should be able to look at those sort of things, you know, in our past, and to be to revisit them, especially like say in a neighborhood as far as Oregon Trail. So it was so significant in the development of this country.
Now you were saying, and if you're just joining us, this is The Conversation on KMUN. We welcome your input and your phone call, 503-325-0010. We'd love to have you join the conversation. We're talking about film and the blurred lines between storytelling in film and what gets interpreted as historical fact. And then, Ron, you said that once you discovered documentary filmmaking, that that was your path because of its connection to historical accuracy and not, you know, kind of creating false narratives or misleading people about history.
Well, yeah, and it's one of those things, like, you know, the idea that you look at things, so like even what's going on with Hemingway right now, as far as all of a sudden people are rediscovering who he was, what he was, what he wasn't, and things of that nature and stuff. But like I said, once again, like I said, for my upfront sort of experiences with, you know, Lewis and Clark, and people understanding that the journals actually, because they were on a military expedition, so it was, you know, same thing, different day, and knowing where those journals were going to go, were going back to the president. And so it was pretty specific as far as what was happening. But then later in 1988, there were letters in Louisville, Kentucky, that were discovered in a trunk that William Clark had written to his brother, Jonathan. And these letters had never really been seen, you know, publicly per se, but the idea that you had a more in-depth look at what was really going on, because like I said, the journals initially were not that personal, but as far as Clark writing his brother, so we found out things that we did not know. And like I said, we're talking about 1988. So we're talking about, you know, that's a lot of time between the fact when those are actually written, you know, in 1805, 1806, is the fact that, you know, where, what we actually knew about him as far as an individual, because he was sharing personal experiences. And, you know, from my course, it was experiences that were going with York, his slave, that we didn't even know about it, because we didn't find out until that 88 date that York actually was married, and that information was there. So the fact is not so much to condemn people that well, they didn't know about it, but they were substituting different as far as the truth, saying that he did this or he did that. And so I think at the same time, to be able to look at, you know, what's going on, like as far as Ken Burns, you look at, you know, what he did with baseball and stuff, you know, as far as, you know, you look at that, he had a whole segment that dealt with the Negro League. And people had talked to me, they had no idea. And the fact that Satchel Paige actually had a team in Portland, you know, was a Negro League and stuff. And so all these different things, all of a sudden, to me, it's always, you know, it's the breadcrumbs, it's a treasure hunt. Because every day, I mean, the fact that, you know, you're looking at different aspects of our history, the personal history, and all of a sudden it's like, wow. And it doesn't affect people the same. Like I said, this for me is just very, very personal thing. And I enjoy sharing it with people, you know, the fact that different things happen. Like I said, with the idea that there was a Negro League and out there in Portland back in the 40s, the late 40s. And then the idea that, well, who ran that? I said, well, it's Satchel Paige. Well, then, okay, I'm not expecting everybody to know all this, but yeah, at the same time, that's a whole another avenue to be able to open up on. And so here we go. I love it.
Yeah, it seems to me like the real story are the personal stories. It's,
yes,
it's so much more about the people than it is the accomplishment or the task at hand. And so when we were talking about historical fiction, the one that came to mind for me was the author James Michener, who he writes about places, but he creates people that live in those places. And so the one that stands out to me was the book about Hawaii, where he will start out in the valley in China where the woman that eventually immigrated to Hawaii lived, and he'll tell the story of what was going on in their village and in their culture. And then you have this context for when she encounters other cultures in Hawaii, because it's a very much a melting pot of Asian and South Pacific, and you know, all sorts of people ended up in Hawaii. Obviously, the Mormons and Captain Cook and the Sugar Barons and things like that. And so this is a place where so many cultures and people intersected. And the way he was able to create characters to tell those stories is extraordinary, but it's all fiction. But it really does give you a sense of what was going on. So it's just so interesting what it takes to tell a story and what makes a story interesting. And then also how much actual truth there is to it.
Yeah, that's what has bothered me. You know, it doesn't keep me awake at night, but it's just in the fact of how, you know, like I said, things have changed, like I said, in the 21st century to a degree as far as communication. But the idea that the history books that, you know, for my generation growing up, there are history books that remain the same. They never changed it. It never updated anything, and you got the same thing over and over and over and over. And it goes back to what I was saying earlier, you know, that as far as history and being able to go down the road is finding what's really happening. And like I said, go back to the idea, you know, of the Oregon Trail, and you know, what was the Barlow Trail, you know, and these are obscure things to some degree, but still, again, they're out there to be, you know, investigated, or their curiosity. Because people just don't, you know, they buy it for what's there and just kind of leave it alone. And let's face it, like, everybody's not as curious as we are as far as about history. So it's not condemning anyone, but the fact of being able to open those doors and look at it and see what's going on, it's just like crazy. Because even the fact that somebody would tell me about the local history, as far as everybody talks about, you know, Ford, you know, inventing as far as the cars, you say, or taught the people in Germany, they said, well, no, it was a German who invented the first, you know, automobile, so on and so forth. Well, to be able to look at that just as information, you make your decision one way or another, if you're German or if you're from, you know, Detroit, you know, as far as what you want to put a handle on or believe. But overall, I said, even today, it's one of those things that is very, you know, curious, that people tend to ignore things if it puts, you know, a different spin on it. And as far as the denial that it actually happened.
Yeah. Well, if you're just joining us, it's The Conversation on KMUN, and we are talking about film, talking about documentaries, talking about history, talking about how they intersect. And we even dipped into history books there as well. And so I think the question that we're really going after here is, where do we get our stories from? Where do we get our history from? And how complete is it? And how hard are we digging? And how good are the tools that are available to us? And do we ever mistake the tools, or you know, mistake something that's not a tool for a tool? For example, a fictional film. So I'm curious if there's something in your memory of a film that you watched or a documentary that you saw that opened your eyes. Maybe it was a book that you read. But just where do these planes of fiction and nonfiction and history and historical fiction intersect, and how does that affect our lives? That's a lot of stuff to think about. But if you've got any thoughts, if you'd like to chime in, do give us a call, 503-325-0010. What were you going to say, Ron?
Well, I think the people, you know, as far as, once again, the history and stuff like that is surrounding us, you know, and it goes, you know, as far as how films depict certain aspects of our history. And as I stated earlier and stuff, it's more the fact of entertainment, as far as being able to, you know, look like Meek's Cutoff. Once again, as far as that film, it just was so accurate. But you know, I could see where people said, well, when are the Native Americans going to attack these people? Or when are they going to do square dancing at the end of the day? Or when are they going to do this? Well, that wasn't it. And the fact that being able to look at these films, and for me, once again, it's one of those things of being able to look at them and the reality of what was really happening beyond the fact of, you know, it was a party going on. And one of the things, like a friend of mine says, well, God, you know, where did they get these horses? I said, no, they weren't riding horses, but they were walking. And the fact there were oxen that were pulling the wagons. But like I said, if you look at Hollywood and stuff, it's a whole different thing as far as they're showing these people in these wagons going along. And the fact that, you know, the wagons were, you know, full of their possessions. And the idea that, you know, as far as one of the deals they really deal with in the journals is the fact that childbirth, there were a lot of, you know, deaths, women that died in childbirth and children that died. And somebody had always shared this with me that a lot of times they would talk about the woman being pregnant, but they never talked about the fact of the woman dying or the fact of the child dying. And so these different aspects of our history and stuff, as far as how it is depicted in films, and I don't mean to dwell on not Lewis and Clark, but as far as the Oregon Trail, but like I said, that's so significant because like the fact of being going out of this area, you get west of the Mississippi, well, nothing happened, you know, as far as, you know, other people looking at it and stuff, because everything was there, but it didn't happen, you know, in New York or Cleveland or, you know, like I said, in the Midwest, it didn't happen. And as far as, you know, with the, you look at different aspects of how they depict, you know, quote, the mafia. And I use that not as derogatory, but the idea that to make it exciting, that was what it was about. But what it was really involved, the real life versus the idea that the fact that, yeah, it's a bunch of guys sitting around drinking and, you know, and doing X, Y, Z as far as with the gangsters. And I think the people revisit that in some aspects of it, and like Bonnie and Clyde, you know, you look at that and once again, you know, who were they? You know, well, okay, well, this is who they were. And it's just, like I said, it gets the point to have the curiosity as far as being able to see some aspects of it. And then once again, like I said, the idea of the cowboys as far as being out there and stuff, the cowboys, you know, were African-Americans and, you know, indigenous as far as Spanish, you know, things like that, you know, the fact of what they depicted, but at the same time, that wouldn't have flown very well back in the day as far as the movies. They wanted to look like, you know, John Wayne. And so that was it.
So how far have we come since then?
Oh, God. Yeah, you put me on the spot with that one.
We've come a little bit of a ways, right?
I think so. And I keep saying the fact, you know, with social media and stuff, so it's out there and stuff, that I think when you get people's curiosity, that we have come a bit. And I'm not, you know, it's not a negative approach to it as far as saying that. But like I said, once again, there are things that are still out there within the films. Because I think in the last, you know, few years, there's been more films that really depicted, you know, as far as African Americans beyond the black exploitation films that went on during the, you know, late 60s and the 70s and stuff, which was a different thing, but it has a negative aspect to it. And then at the same time, you know, you look at, you know, Dances with Wolves. What was that about? You know, as far as looking at that, but it still gave you a different doorway as far as looking at, you know, our history. And so I say we've come quite a bit of, you know, as far as the course, finding out about our history. And, yeah, like I said, it's one of the things as far as being able to tell people to be able to go in and check out the different films, documentaries. And like I said, I go back, you know, once again, to Ken Burns, who's, you know, in a kind of controversial situation right now. But yet at the same time, some of the things that he's been able to put out there, he has just put it there and then people looked at it because, like I said, he's very articulate as far as being able to tell the story. And like I said, I have nothing but respect, you know, for him, how he's been able to put it, because when he did the whole thing, he did the Brooklyn Bridge, you know, things of that nature he had done, like I said, the Lewis and Clark, like I said, the jazz, you know, and I use him as an example. There are other people that are out there doing things like that, but he has the ultimate platform as far as PBS. And so it really helps as far as putting that history out there.
So I'm curious whether, because it's been a while since I saw Dances with Wolves. Does that one hold up?
I believe it does. And I'll be very frank with you, about a week ago, I watched it again. And it's kind of a long film. And I had not sit down and just really, watch the whole thing from beginning to end. And I did. And like I said, there's some miscues on stuff like that. But mm-hmm. At the same time, it did put a lot of the things that were happening during that time period historically, as far as, what was happening with the indigenous tribes during that time period, which they did their research on and stuff. But like I said, it's a Hollywood film. But I think I recommend it for people to be able to look at it, because it does take us a lot further as far as the sensitivity that was really going on during that time period.
Yeah, I remember it being pretty profound when it came out. Got a lot of attention. I should watch it again.
I definitely recommend it before I take another look at it. But
if someone is listening and they are unfamiliar with what blaxploitation films are, what's the deal there?
Well, basically what it was is that, we'll take it even further back than that. I mean, there were films and filmmakers doing in the 20s, African American and stuff like that, but they were targeted to, as far as the African American community, which African American community and stuff, the theaters, you couldn't go to the theaters unless you sat upstairs. And there were very few theaters that were owned by African Americans during that time period. The black exploitation films, like I said, those back in the 20s and stuff was kind of, the sort of musical things, genres. But it really was kind of a mirror of what was going on culturally in the African-American communities. Yet it wasn't across the board, because within the African-American community, as far as like the NAACP and a couple other areas and stuff, the people, they did not like it, because it was depicting, a lot of African-Americans, drug dealers, violence, just no morals. And typically the black churches, they kind of rejected it. But yet at the same time, the people that were funding this, as far as Hollywood, they realized that there was an underserved portion. And you have films like, Blackula. So Dracula was black, right? Mm-hmm. And we have, the one Cross 110th Street, Cotton Comes to Harlem. You can understand how it was targeted to the African-American community. So part of it is that I'm kind of, I won't say upset about it, but the fact that being able to put that out there, because they realized there was an underserved market. But then at the same time, as that kind of diminished, it just went away completely. And now, within the 21st century and stuff, as far as where we are now, more films are coming out, and they're more realistic, because the people that are out there, the young people, are the filmmakers and stuff, they're doing a lot of their research. Once again, looking at the history of what really happened, other than the fact of just playing to the star power. And so, but it's, like I say, black exploitation films and stuff, it's totally credible. It's millions of dollars are being made, but, and there are a lot of actors, producers that were, as far as being out there, they didn't have any jobs, but all of a sudden they got these films are going on. But then once that kind of, disappeared stuff, that genre, it was like, what do I do next? Well, make a job selling toothpaste or whatever it is, which wasn't even happening then, because African Americans were not on TV doing advertisements, stuff like their commercials. So the black exploitation, like I said, it really served a portion. And also the music that was involved in it, as far as the music got more air, I think, than actually the subject matter and stuff a lot of times, because there were, this number of different awards that were going out, major awards going out to the music that mm-hmm. was created for that genre.
Interesting. Well, hey, we've got a call. It's Paul.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt again, but my most favorite movie was A Patch of Blue with Sidney Poitier and Shelley Winters. I think it was in the early 60s that came out. But it was an incredible movie, opened my mind, I hope other people's minds, to the facts of life. The other thing I wanted to say is I've just been so disappointed in filmmaking, both movies and TV. I don't know what these acting studios are teaching actors, but it seems to be run, roll, shoot, and that's about it. There doesn't seem to be a whole lot of content to feed your soul and stimulate your mind. Run, roll, shoot. Oh, well.
Maybe we got to look to books then.
Well, thank you, Graham. Have a wonderful day. And by the way, there's a check coming.
Oh, love it. Love it. Thank you, Paul.
Okay, take care.
You too. So the storyline there on A Patch of Blue is that a accidentally blinded by her prostitute mother, Roseanne, at the age of 5, spends the next 13 years confined in a tiny Los Angeles apartment that they share with Selena's grandfather. And then she meets Gordon Ralph, a thoughtful young office worker whose kind-hearted treatment of her results in her falling in love with him, unaware that he's black. They continue to meet in the park every afternoon, and he teaches her how to get along in the city. But when the cruel, domineering Roseanne learns of their relationship, she forbids her to have anything more to do with him because he's black. Selena continues to meet Gordon despite Roseanne's fury, who's determined to end the relationship for good. And that was 1965. So sounds like an interesting one. Sidney Poitier and Shelley Winters.
Well, those films, like I said, once again, Sidney, he was kind of the five-star, artist as far as, his... I said his roles weren't threatening culturally to some degree, but in talking about how some of these films are put together and stuff, you think about as far as Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, as far as once again the racial history and as far as how we're looking at it, as far as documenting. And I didn't realize this came out, I think it was in 68, 67, somewhere around that, but. There was two versions of that, and I didn't know that, like I said, years later, because if anybody's seen the movie, the early portion of the movie has, Sidney's love goes to pick him up at the airport and get into a cab, and they're in the back seat of the cab, and she actually kiss, and they deleted that portion of the film in the South. So it was two versions of it. And I've told that to people before, and they kind of looked at me and kind of like, what the heck? I said, yeah, the fact that you're having an African-American and a white woman in the backseat of the cab in San Francisco kissing and stuff is the fact that they deleted it. So if you were sitting there in Atlanta or wherever it is, you were not going to see Sidney do that. So, it's just no, as far as, A Patch of Blue, the fact that it was okay until the fact that she realized he was black. So, we deal with, social things, but at the same time as documenting actual circumstances of that time period.
Yeah, I wish I could say I was surprised that would happen. But hopefully we can say we've come a long ways since then.
Well, I think for me, it's like even today, as far as sharing that in certain situations and stuff, people are still kind of looking at it with a little disbelief that it happened, but the idea that why did this happen, were people that alienated the fact or that racist that they didn't want that to happen? I said, yeah. And like I said, it wasn't 100 years ago. Like I say, it wasn't that long ago.
Sadly. Yep. That's true. I think that's one of the amazing things about history, especially in the United States, is that, the country's not that old in the grand scheme of things.
No. And I think that's what, gets people. The idea that these things still exist. And because some of the posts that I do as far as social media about U.S. history and stuff is the fact that people coming back, almost like once again, as far as disbelief of these things happening. And one of the taglines for me that's always kind of crazy was, I think one woman was the first woman to graduate from Harvard University or something like that, first black woman, the first, black woman was a pilot or things of that nature and stuff. It's just like, it's just the first person, because even now history is being made daily as far as putting, whether it's women you know, or indigenous people, African Americans in certain places in our government. And you figure, like, you know, how long has our government been around and stuff like that in the U.S. and stuff. But all of a sudden, it's the people saying, you mean that's the first person who's ever served in that position in the U.S. government? And I said, I'm not making this up. This is what it's about. And so it's, you know, the subtext of it is the fact that, you know, it's not like so much the people are not educated, because it's like, you know, this big deal with, as far as reparation, as far as, you know, and you see these, you know, whether it's indigenous or, you know, well, as far as being out there, and the reason you did not weren't accepted because you didn't have the education. Well, then the education was denied you. And so once again, you get in the situation with, you know, with films, as far as what's being pushed out there, as far as trying to educate people, as far as what's really happening. Like I said, it can be, you know, a misconception. In fact, well, they're the indigenous people. They're just out hanging out. They're not doing anything. You know, they have no ambition. Well, the fact if you're locked away in an area and you're not allowed to be able to be part of the culture or to be able to contribute, is not the fact that, you know, your inability is the fact you're not allowed it. And so, like I say, with the films, as far as putting them out there and stuff, as far as, you know, getting really involved in it, I think we're getting more involved because there's a whole generation sort of thing that's going on right now. I don't really have that much reservation as far as, you know, what things are going, how people are depicting our history and stuff, because once again, we have an opportunity to be able to look at it and to make some sort of assessment of what's really going on. And as I said, you can't step around the fact of some of the political things that are going on right now, because people are writing scripts right now for what's going on.
What do you foresee in that way? Like, what do you mean?
Well, okay. I had written this thing as a request and stuff about what's going on right now. And I used the tagline as far as what's happening within the communities, as far as the African-Americans being, you know, killed, stuff like that. And I called it a contemporary lynching. Mm-hmm. And the person that I got it back to, he said, oh my God, the 21st century, as far as, you know, getting the details, why are all these people being killed, you know, in the circumstances, things like that. And like I said, it's just like, okay, back in the day, you know, you can get a postcard right now online of an African-American being lynched, and everybody's standing around there on a Sunday afternoon, kids and everything, smiling, whatever it is. And so at the same time, you know, you look at situations that happen today, people are standing around, and why are these things happening? And like all of a sudden, you know, the fact that there's a couple of different things going on where they're trying to, you know, do some sort of reparation as far as indigenous tribes, as far as the land that was taken away from them. And like I said, people don't really understand what that was all about, you know, from a historical perspective. But then all these things that were signed and accepted and stuff like that, well, you're going to be this, 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 this. And it's just, I think it's just really interesting to see how it's kind of developing.
Yeah. Well, we've come a long way, but we've got a long way to go.
Oh, yeah.
Ron, thanks for joining me today. I would like to spend a couple of minutes just talking a little bit more about our spring pledge drive. One thing that I love to do is to share some of the listener comments that we get. And so if any of these ring true for you and you think you might want to join in the cause and make a donation, I would love it if this was your motivation. So Ami is a big fan of Bee's House, Lisa Smith, and Indigify Tunes. She appreciates the awesomeness in the forms of Janine Jackson of Counterspin and Michael McCusker of A Story Told. Jennifer and Mark in Astoria support Mark Metalark and Caribbean Moon, great reggae every Friday night. Amy and Dan say, we love KMUN. We're new residents of Astoria, and KMUN has kept us connected to the community during our pandemic move. David in Framingham says, I really enjoyed Jerry's Wednesday morning folk show. And hey, guess what? That's coming up in about 10 minutes. So stay tuned right here for some great folk with Jerry Middaugh this morning. And how about this one? Rodney in Cathlamet has been a listener for years. Really appreciates the spectrum of music and talk programming that he can't get anywhere else. Steven says, I like so many shows and I feel good about supporting. I don't use the internet at home, so KMUN is a big part of life. So there you have it. There's some listener comments and testimonials. How about you? What do you love about the show? If you want to give us a call, what do you love about the radio station? You can also tell me what you love about this show. 503-325-0010. We could sneak in a few phone calls if you want to just give a shout out to your favorite DJ, your favorite programmer, your favorite public affairs show. Give us a ring and let us know why you support KMUN. 503-325-0010. I gotta say that the variety is a big part of what makes KMUN great. And, you know, we understand that maybe you don't love everything on the station, but I bet there's something that you love. And the more you listen, the more you'll find, because there's always something different. We like to remind people that we are algorithm-free since 1983. That means that it's not a computer program that's choosing what song you hear next. It's a human being with a story of their own, sitting right here in a chair, right here at a mixer with a microphone, two turntables, two CD players. We've got laptops. We've got inputs for external gear. And we train folks to make radio for free. And our volunteers don't get paid. They do it out of the goodness of their hearts. But we've got a small, hardworking staff that makes all that training happen and helps with all the back office type stuff, keeps members up to date. 503-325-0010. If you'd like to call in the next few minutes to give a shout-out to your favorite DJ, I'll give a shout-out. How about DJ the L.I.M.? Liam Dunn was the first voice on the air in 1983. And I don't know, and he is quoted as saying, "Welcome to the birth of a radio station." Dun-dun-dun. And Liam is still here. He's still with us. He's still a huge part of the radio. He still plays incredible playlists every other Thursday from 1 to 3 p.m. And he rotates with DJ Kano, who also does an amazing radio show. It's stuff that I can guarantee that you'd never hear if you left it up to the algorithms to send you your next piece of music. So lots of reasons to support KMUN. Won't you join in the fun? You can go to coastradio.org and click the red donate button, or you can call 503-325-0010. Ron, is there anything that you're looking forward to from the film industry in the next couple weeks or months?
Well, yeah, you start listening to all these, entertainment as far as what's going on, the fact of, they were saying that people were ignored, people of color as far as, entertainment, things like that, as far as the movies. And like I said, part of the thing was, like I said, I kept, Ken Burns and stuff, the idea that people will come back, talking about the fact that he was the only voice at PBS, as far as doing that. But, they need to open it up to more people. But, he's there and, he's doing his job. I'm just looking forward to more young people, getting involved in it. Because like I said, the stories are being told, like I said, it's not like we're as adults or mature is ignoring it, but I think it's just really kind of beautiful to be able to do that. And I think, that allowing, like I said, again, as far as, women being involved and, as far as the, communities being able to tell those stories, I'm just looking forward to more of it.
That's beautiful. I love it. Yeah, there's a new generation of filmmakers coming around the corner, and more women, more people of color, more indigenous filmmakers, more stories, more context, more perspectives.
And there's more, in fact, transgender. I look at that, as far as people, and I do that specifically, the fact that I have, people I've consulting with and stuff like that, the stories that need to be told, and that need to be told. And like being able to give a platform to be able to tell those stories and stuff. I love it. I think it's just, a good direction we're going at, and anything I can ever do to be able to, help facilitate that, I'm the front line.
Very cool. Well, Ron, I appreciate you coming on the show today.